This is Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. A group of Central Illinois pilgrims made a nonstop trip to Philadelphia to see Pope Francis.
He is like Christ, period. He doesn't care who you are, what you are. He's there for you.
Diane Wheelwright says this pope has had a profound impact on her life. You'll accompany Judy Valente on a pilgrimage to see Pope Francis. The Nashville-based bluegrass band, the Steel Drivers, are headed to Bloomington for another show. Bruce Bergathon talks to fiddler Tammy Rogers. And you'll visit the ISU exhibit of seedy Chicago-area early 20th century crime photos, Gangsters and Grifters. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Best of Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. A powerhouse bluegrass quintet returns to the Castle Theater this month, hot on the heels of their fourth recording. WGLT's Bruce Bergathon spoke with founding member Tammy Rogers, who says it's all about the songs.
Never would have hitchhiked to Birmingham if it hadn't been for love. Never would have called the train to Louisiana if it hadn't been for love. Never would have run through the blinding rain without $1 to my name if it hadn't been, for love.
The Steel Drivers are a band of Nashville veterans who've been making their livings as session musicians, record producers, and staff songwriters for decades. Since 2007, they've been recording their own material and touring, and they'll be returning to Bloomington this month in a show at the Castle Theater October 15th. The Steel Drivers' music mixes up a lot of genres. You just heard a song from their first album, If It Hadn't Been for Love, which the British singer Adele has been performing in her live shows. She calls the Steel Drivers a brilliant blues, country, bluegrass, and swagger band. Fiddler, vocalist, and Steel Driver founding member Tammy Rogers likes that characterization.
Pretty much nailed it. I think that's a great description of the band. I mean, she kind of gets it. She got the whole, you know, all the different influences that come together for the band. So I love it that she said that.
Where did you come up with that name?
The Steel Drivers? I would like to take credit for it, but I can't. When the band first got together, we were tossing around names and, you know, you got to call yourself something. Mike Henderson, one night we got together and he said, how about the Steel Drivers? And he said, well, it came to me in a dream. So there you go.
Did he know what a steel driver?
Yeah, with the railroad and the John Henry was a steel driving man. Yeah, he knew all those songs. But I think for him, the connection was, you know, we play on steel strings and the music tends to be pretty hard edged and driving. That was, I think, his connection to it more than the railroad stuff, really.
You have been in a lot of different bands. Just about everybody in the Steel Drivers has worked in a variety of other parts of the Nashville music industry. What do you get to do in the Steel Drivers that you don't get to do in your other work in the music business?
Playing music that harkens back to the blues and bluegrass and Appalachian music that's not maybe as overtly commercial as a lot of the stuff that I've done since I've lived in Nashville, and that it's all original. You know, when you're doing recording sessions for a living, which I've done a lot of, or touring with other country acts, which I've also done a good bit of, you're typically helping to realize somebody else's musical vision, if you will. And that's what you get paid to do. You know, you want to make somebody's record sound the best it can, but you're also, you know, realizing that you're there to facilitate their vision. You know, I toured with Reba, was my last country gig. You know, you're there to recreate what was on her recording or make her sound great every night, which she sounds great. She's awesome. But you know what I mean? So that, to me, is the biggest difference. I mean, being in a band like this, And we set out early on doing all original music, and we've really stuck by that, for better or for worse. The big thing for me that I think we all bring to the Steel Drivers is having played so many different styles of music and for so many different people, you really develop kind of a respect for the material at hand. We take the songs that are initially the ones written by Mike and Chris, or now the ones that Gary and I are writing, and really try to come up with an arrangement that highlights the song, not just about, oh, listen to this really cool lick that I can play. It's really based on what seems to serve the song best.
I ain't seen no lipstick on your collar, no number written on a dollar bill. I can't help but wonder where you've been tonight, and I can't shake the way it makes me feel.
I wonder how you coordinate all your other day jobs in the industry with the activities of the Steel Drivers. I mean, can you set aside priority time for this band with all the other ways you have to be busy to make a living?
Oh, I definitely do. And some of that, I think, through the years kind of takes care of itself. I mean, typically we're traveling Thursday through Saturday, or maybe Friday through Sunday. So most of my weekdays, I'm pretty available to do sessions or songwriting, or I still teach one day a week at Belmont University, and that's usually on a Tuesday. So, I mean, it's a good bit of juggling, but it's just kind of what I'm used to, so I don't think a lot about it. I try to just take it a week or two at a time and not get too overwhelmed with, you know, looking 6 months ahead.
But you kind of reserve the weekends for the Steel Drivers?
Yeah, pretty much. And if I'm not, you know, out with the Steel Drivers, and I've, you know, I'm married and I have a daughter that just turned 13, so I like to hang out with them.
Is she a musician too?
She is. She's playing piano and guitar and singing. She's not necessarily enamored with bluegrass and Americana stuff yet, but she likes some of it. She likes the Steel Drivers, of course, and she loves Della May, you know, that kind of modern bluegrass meets string band kind of music she likes. She'll probably get around to it. My husband plays electric guitar, so she hears a lot of that kind of stuff, too.
You have plenty of virtuoso ammunition, and I think that's true of the rest of the Steel Drivers as well. How do you keep yourself from showing off?
Well, I think that's maturity. I mean, none of us are young guns anymore. I mean, we've all been doing this a long time, and, you know, going back to that phrase, playing what's right for the song, that we all approach it from that place. That's a mature kind of place. It's not about how many notes I can play or how fast I can play them. It's what I think is musically best for the tune.
One of the things about maturity is that you learn how to take care of yourself on the road. There's a lot of songs in the Steel Drivers repertoire about not taking care of yourself in a spectacular fashion.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, are those just reminiscences for you guys, or do you party just as hard as you play when you're on the road?
Oh, you know, speaking for myself, that's definitely taking artistic license there. The payback these days is way harder than what it's worth to me. On certain days, you might have a different answer from some of the guys in the band, but I'm not going to tell any tales.
Drinking dark whiskey, telling white lies. One leads to another on Saturday night. And don't you cross your heart unless you hope to die. Drinking dark whiskey, telling white lies.
Drinking Dark Whiskey from the first Steel Drivers album. They've just released their fourth album called the Muscle Shoals Recordings. Muscle Shoals is a legendary studio where Aretha Franklin, Wilson Pickett, the Rolling Stones, and Leonard Skinner, among others, all recorded. It's in Sheffield, Alabama, also the home of the Steel Drivers' current lead singer, Gary Nichols. Nichols is the only member of the quintet who doesn't live in Nashville. Tammy Rogers has been there for a long time, and she doesn't mind being described as a veteran of the country music industry.
I've been here, and I've been blessed to work very consistently and very steadily for almost 25 years. I've lived through a lot of change, and I think about it a lot because I'm working with young people now that are on the opposite end of that. You know, kids that are coming to Belmont that are wanting to have, you know, a career in music or wanting to become a professional musician. And I've seen it change a lot over those 25 years, and we're not done changing at all. I mean, we're still trying to sort out, I mean, the whole Taylor Swift thing in the news about pulling her music off, you know, Spotify and Pandora, that takes a lot of guts. She's got the money now and the power to be able to do that and make a lot of noise, but it's noise that needs to be made for songwriters. You know, I personally had a publishing deal for 8 years as well and got paid to write songs. But that whole industry has changed so drastically. The whole streaming thing, it's not even pennies anymore. I mean, it's like a thousandth of a penny or something for a play on a streaming service. It's crazy. It's crazy. And I don't really know what's going to turn that around for the actual business, you know, of the music. I mean, I know if I had to be dependent upon my songwriter's royalties, I'd be doing something else. On the other hand, it's giving a lot of opportunity for people who are willing to go out and tour and willing to build a fan base. It's kind of like things have reverted back to the way they were probably in the 20s and 30s, 40s, almost like do it yourself. You get out, you tour, you build a fan base, you make your records, you sell them, you go home. You know, the technology is there now that you can do a record for very little money. I'm not saying it's all bad. It's just different.
What can a young artist do to break through other than going on American Idol
and getting
their music out there? What do you tell your students at Belmont?
Try to get a web presence. Try to get social media is huge, and it's pretty much free. And then to try to get out and play in front of people any way you can. You know, if you can build up a local following and then branch out from there, and that's really how you got to do it, I think, is get out and play live and get out and play in front of people.
And you're confident that in a post-digital world is still going to be something of value to fans and audience members?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I can see even with us, I mean, we're still going out and touring, and we're going back to markets that we've played now, you know, third time, fourth time, fifth time, sixth time, and each time our audience has grown. I mean, we're going back to some markets now, and we're selling 700 tickets. We're selling 900 tickets, just us, not being part of a festival. And I think when you can build up that type of fan base and see it, and that starts really adding up.
We're very excited that you're going to be back in Bloomington, and I really appreciate you taking some time to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we're looking forward to coming back too, especially we haven't kind of hit that region in a while, so it'll be interesting to see, you know, if our fan base has continued to grow there. I hope so.
Tammy Rogers, one of the founding members of the band called the Steel Drivers, coming to the Castle Theater on Thursday, October 15th. The other members of the band are vocalist Gary Nichols, mandolinist Brent Truitt, banjo player Richard Bailey, and bassist Mike Fleming. The Steel Drivers' latest release is the Muscle Shoals Recordings. I'm Bruce Bergathon.
And the Steel Drivers are playing at the Castle Theater next Thursday. That's October 15th. We're hearing music from their latest album, the Muscle Shoals Recordings, featured this weekend on GLT's Acousticity. You can hear the best in folk, Celtic, and bluegrass Sunday nights from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. and 24/7 on our folk web stream at WGLT.org. You're tuned to Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern.
Too much sugar, too much caffeine. Too much violence on my TV. Too much commercial on the radio. Too much traffic everywhere I go. Too much hurry, everybody's in a rush. I don't worry about me too much. Too much confusion, too much rules. Too much opinion blaring on the news. Too much destruction, too much war, too much power behind that big white door. Too much mouth, can't seem to keep it shut. I don't worry about it too much. Anybody else might get mad and want to start a fight, but the way I see it, y'all, it'll all be alright.
Support for GLT comes from the Garlic Press, where friends meet friends for lunch at the Market Cafe, or shopping for a special gift, the perfect card, or a needed kitchen tool. Celebrating 40 years, the Garlic Press is proud to be a community destination. This is GLT.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, Best of Sound Ideas, you'll journey to Philadelphia with a group of Central Illinois pilgrims to see Pope Francis. Judy Valente's report is coming up during Best of Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Willis Kern. If you're at all sentimental about the past, look away from the current exhibit up at ISU's Milner Library. Now, next week, two photojournalists will be at ISU to explain their work. There's no romanticizing an era full of guns, gore, and gangsters. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more about this exhibit and the book that inspired it.
Down, down deep beneath the streets of Chicago, beneath acres of steel and asphalt, the city's sordid history has been resurrected and published in a collection of vintage crime photos capturing the famous, the infamous, and the obscure figures of Chicago. Created from the vast underground archives of the Chicago Tribune, the book Gangsters and Grifters has spawned an exhibit at Illinois State University's Milner Library. Blown-up digital black and white photos taken from glass plate 4x5 negatives line the walls of the main floor of the library lobby, standing in stark contrast to the backpack-wearing, cell phone-toting students who work busily on computers nearby. Librarian Kathleen Lawnbaum says as soon as she saw Gangsters and Grifters, she wanted to spotlight the efforts of the photo editors at the Chicago Tribune who curated the book. The photos depict the raw reality of the Prohibition era. But according to Lawnbaum, the photos offer much more than mere shock value.
Now, Laura, if you look really closely at this, what's really fascinating, the smoke coming out of the guns, you'll see the whirl of a fingerprint that would have been left on the glass plate negative. And that was one of the things the photo editors made a choice when they had these files digitized. You can see things like thumbprints. You'll see the cracks in the glass negative. So that adds to the richness of the process. You know, we're also used to pulling out our cameras, our phones, and using them, but this is a whole other technology and history of photography represented here.
So the flaw in the photo really becomes a telling part of its history. It's not a flaw today for us to look at this in this regard.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, Kathleen, what has most surprised you when you were looking at these photos? What really took you aback?
You know, I think the human element in all of these really comes through. The pictures, whether the picture of Clarence Darrow with his head down, it's obviously a moment of high drama in the courtroom.
This is where he was arguing the murder case regarding Leopold and Loeb.
Yes, yes. It's just these moments, the look between Leopold and Loeb, we were all struck by this, especially when the image was enlarged. And I should mention, these images were enlarged by Milner Library's Digital Center. They did an incredible job because these were taken from image files that would have been, they were nice-sized files, but the original photos would have been much smaller. But when you talk about a moment, if you look at that gaze between the two, you know, what story is being told?
I don't even have the words to describe how it is they're looking at each other. And you can only imagine what's going on in their minds after they both gave separate confessions to the murder of the 14-year-old boy.
Yes, yes. So that I think the human element that comes through in all of these is what's most striking to me.
Marianne Mather agrees. She's a photo editor at the Chicago Tribune and spent hours and hours in the sub-basement of the Tribune Tower doing an inventory on the historic glass plate negatives. Mather says the images were so compelling that she and her fellow editors had to collect and publish them in the book Gangsters and Grifters. The grisly array of bloody corpses, hardened gun mauls, and anguished crime victims also features some of the biggest figures of Chicago crime: Capone, Dillinger, Leopold, and Loeb. The photos are in rich black and white. They're stark and often brutal, calling to mind, Mather says, classic film noir.
I think that was probably one of the most striking things for us as photo editors, because all we have for our frame of reference is the movies we've seen. It's very film noir. But when we started going through the photographs, I mean, this was the real life. This was it right here. And we tried to make sure that we selected images that really portrayed that this was average everyday people's lives, along with, you know, the bigger names of Capone and Dillinger and people like that are well known in, you know, Chicago history.
There's some very startling photos. One of the most interesting, I thought, was a photo of Public Enemy Number One, John Dillinger, laid out on a slab in front of a glass plate window, and all these people are ogling his corpse, and you've got a couple of young women in
bathing suits
and they're leaning up against the window, and it's absolutely astonishing that this photo ever took place, and it seems to reveal that back in the day that there was a level of access that the media had back then that we just can't even think about now.
Well, there was a level of access for everyone back then that we just don't have now. I mean, before that photo, it took me a while to figure out in that photo, what's going on here? What's happening? Why are these people lined up against this glass, you know, looking in at this body? How did this happen? And after digging through the old newspaper articles, it talked about how we found that people were able to go through the morgue. They actually didn't put them behind glass at first. They were walking up and touching the body. And then finally, you know, the police came and said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. You know, you guys can't be touching the body, because people were making what they call death masks of his face, which is basically like a plaster cast of his face. I mean, it was a free-for-all, basically. And that line of people that you see, especially the two women in the bathing suits, this line was all the way around the block, around the morgue. So people were lined up to view this body, and then the photographer, of course, had the access to take the photo right there. It's all very astonishing.
Yeah, I love the photos of a crime scene where you have all these cops in a semicircle around a corpse. There's a sheet over it, and they're holding the sheet up to let the photographer from the Trib take the picture.
Yeah, that's Alfred J. Klingel. He was actually a Tribune reporter who got probably a little too cozy with gangsters at the time. And that particular photo, I mean, that was very indicative of a lot of the photos of that time period, where the police, the reporters and photographers were so close to the police and to the gangsters that they were able to get there sometimes before the police officers did, or the police would wait and lift the sheet up and say, here, you can get your shot, which that would obviously not happen at all today. The photos that we uncovered of John Dillinger were very surprising, because we didn't know that they were there. We found them through a couple listings that said Michigan City Prison Break. And then we realized, oh, wait, this is a box full of John Dillinger photos. And so there's a particular photo of him sitting in the courtroom for his 1934 murder trial hearing. And it's a dark photo. It's very film noir. Mm-hmm. He's only one in white. You know, he's wearing that vest that he always wears, and he's in white. The light is just on him. He's slouching. He's handcuffed to a person, you know, police officer next to him. And he looks like he doesn't care. He's nonplussed to be there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that photo, we believe, has never been seen before.
Well, you have gone through thousands and thousands of these. How did you go about trying to make your selections for the book?
Right. So the other two photo editors, Robin Daughtridge and Aaron Harper, and I had a really tough time, since most of the photos were really fantastic. But we really wanted to make sure that they were powerful images that were of everyday life. That was very important to us, that showed the people as real human beings. And we wanted them to tell a story, not just be a flashy, sensationalistic image. So you'll see a lot of the pictures in the book really have a lot of context that go with them to be able to explain what's happening in the photo, so we can understand the people and the time better.
It's fun, of course, to look at the criminals. You have a great photo of Al Capone, looking remarkably sheepish for Al Capone, going into, I think, a courtroom. But there's also photographs of tests of law enforcement tools that are very common today, like a lie detector. And there was a guy actually standing behind a bulletproof piece of material, and these cops are shooting at him. And it's
we just keep laughing at. You know, there's, like you said, some of these photos are beautiful, and we feel bad because, oh, this is kind of graphic stuff, and we think they're beautiful. This one we just keep laughing at. You know, the photo of the inventor of the metal bulletproof shield. You know, and we always joke he's literally standing behind his work as these police officers, you know, shoot at him. I can't imagine that there's other officers just standing nearby. It's a preposterous situation.
They do reveal stark reality in these photos, but really there's a beauty to these photos in the lighting and the composition. That Dillinger photo in the courtroom that you were referencing earlier, it looks like it could have been an old master who placed everybody perfectly in that photograph. That photographer really had an eye.
Yeah, and you know, it's sad to us because back then they didn't write down or keep any record of who the photographers were. So we don't have any record of who shot which photo, which is kind of sad to us as photo editors and photographers. So we'd like to honor those people who did really spend a good deal of time crafting these images in a really compelling way.
Marianne, can we at all still tell stories like these with current photography, crime photography?
Definitely. I think that the photographers today have maybe a tougher job in the way that there is a barrier between them and what's going on, a much greater barrier. When they go to crime scenes, they really have to, they don't obviously work with the police officers anymore, and they don't work with gang members and things like that. But I think that's probably for the best, because we need to stay more observant and not involve ourselves in the situations. And so in that way, it does make the job a little bit more difficult, but there are so many stories out there to tell. And these photojournalists that we work with at the Chicago Tribune are just fantastic at it. So there's really compelling stories that they're able to still tell today, which is wonderful.
You have many of the photos blown up, are on display here at Illinois State University right now. What do you hope the students here at ISU glean from this exhibit of photos of the gangsters and grifters?
Well, I think that the photos themselves, the fact that what we were talking about earlier, how our only frame of reference is this kind of film noir, what we've seen in movies, you know, and that's what we keep going back to, like that Dillinger photo. It looks like a scene from a movie, but I hope that the students will realize that this was real. This happened right here, and that there was a different way that these were produced as well, you know, with the glass plate negatives and what the photographers and photojournalists had to go through to get these images, and what the newspapers did and how they presented them too. That's something that's very interesting to look back at now, and we can reflect on what's happening today with that information.
That's Marianne Mather, photo editor of the Chicago Tribune and editor of Gangsters and Grifters. Coming up Tuesday, October 13th at 4 p.m. in Milner Library, Mather and her colleague Robin Dottridge are appearing to discuss the research and discoveries that led to Gangsters and Grifters. Milner librarian Kathleen Lonbaum says they hope the photos can inform and inspire students from across academic disciplines.
This is one of the really stunning photographs of Leopold and Loeb. The fabric of their suits, that wool blend, it feels like you could touch it. It's incredible. And the other thing we discovered, so I was talking about faculty and students in School of Art, School of Theater and Dance, but then we realized as I started talking to my colleagues in the library, the history of Chicago, the crime scene in Chicago in the early 20th century. So from an interdisciplinary perspective, we were all really excited. Journalism, photo documentation, people are very interested. When we were hanging the exhibit, students were gathering around, watching and looking. You know, from looking at the publication, there were quite a few images that are pretty graphic that you would never see in newspapers today of shooting scenes.
Yes, we're looking at one right now that depicts a crime reporter was shot and killed. And so this reporter, who probably took a few photos of some dead gangsters in his day, is now lying in a pool of blood, and they're all posing around the body.
And he was a contemporary and supposedly had connections with Al Capone, so there was speculation that he was working both sides with Al Capone and then being a journalist also. Once again, from a theater perspective, a lot of these photographs are meaningful. The theater doing makeup, the students that come in to look for books with forensic photography of gunshot wounds. It was another reason I thought the book would be a great purchase for the collection.
Did you at all have any debate here at the library about putting up graphic photos in the library, how people might react to that?
We did. The group of librarians that I was working with, this is an open space, so we didn't want to put up anything that might be too shocking. But then again, we also talked about students and children specifically are exposed to quite a bit. We were conservative in our approach. If you look in the book, you'll see others that are far more graphic.
A selection of photos from Gangsters and Grifters will be on display at ISU's Milner Library through November 1st. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Chicago Tribune photo editors Marianne Mather and Robin Dottridge will talk Gangsters and Grifters at 4 o'clock next Tuesday in the Circus Room of the Bone Student Center. Mather says a sequel to Gangsters and Grifters is a definite possibility. You can see the photos, some of the photos, referenced in this piece right now at WGLT.org. Gangsters and Grifters is a look back at crime. As we look ahead at crime, it's crime and technology. An ISU criminal justice professor has co-authored a book that looks at domestic violence through the lens of social media and technology. Coming up during Best of Sound Ideas, Charlie Schlenker has that interview. I'm Willis Kern. Pope Francis's historic visit to Philadelphia last month drew more than a million people. Among them was WGLT's Judy Valente, who accompanied a group of pilgrims from central Illinois. They drove through the night in a van to get there, hoping for a glimpse of the man in white. They got that and much more. Here's their story.
A three-quarter moon rises over the parking lot of St. Joseph Church in Roanoke, our starting point for this pilgrimage to see Pope Francis. There is excitement and a bit of anxiety, too, as our travelers look ahead to the trip.
I probably won't see the Pope. I don't think I would be close enough. But just to be in the same city as he is, it just generates so much excitement for me.
That's Letitia Hill, the oldest member of our group, who is 78, the same age, she will proudly tell you, as Pope Francis. Kathy Bylow, the St. Joseph parishioner who organized the trip, hopes the country will see a different side of Catholicism.
A lot of people think the Catholic Church is about the Gold Dome cathedrals and, you know, and a lot of opulence. And this Pope reflects the opposite.
May the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit descend upon you and remain with you forever.
Amen.
As the 10 of us stand beside a van built for 12, now loaded down with our suitcases and snack bags, Monsignor Charles Beebe, pastor of St. Joseph, offers a blessing.
I will watch for you on television. I'll see if I see you.
Our group includes a 19-year-old student from Chicago's DePaul University traveling with her mother, also an insurance agent, an information technology specialist, two nurses, two teachers, and the ordained deacon of St. Joseph Church traveling with his wife. Most are lifelong Catholics, but two are converts, including Deacon Terry Stahlsberg, who has a particular reason to be excited.
I'll be helping distribute communion on Sunday. I'll be able to participate in the Mass and just being a servant. You know, being a deacon is about serving others.
Our little group represents the challenge this Pope faces as he tries to minister to the vast tent known as the Catholic Church. Though church teaching condemns it, some in our group are divorced or have children who are divorced. The church opposes same-sex marriage and sex outside of marriage. One of the pilgrims is a woman who has been with her partner for 15 years. They are raising two foster children. Theirs is just the sort of non-traditional family the church increasingly is finding in the Sunday pews. And this group also illustrates vividly that Catholics do not represent a clearly defined voting bloc, nor do they walk in lockstep with their church's teaching. Mary Jo Roseman, a retired pediatric nurse and another of the pilgrims, bristles at being defined by any political label.
I am for social justice, for helping the poor, and I don't care how we do it, we need to do it. And if you're wealthy, you know, we need to be giving, and even us poor people need to be giving.
But ask her about same-sex marriage.
We have a sacrament of marriage, and that's between a man and a woman, because that is what works. Our bodies are designed physically to be with a man and a woman.
Still, she says she has taken to heart the Pope's famous response when he was asked about homosexuality early on in his papacy. He said, "Who am I to judge?"
I have no condemnation for them. That's between them and their maker. And I have family and friends who are gay. And I'm no better a person than they are, you know.
Before his trip to America, Francis also announced a streamlined process for granting annulments to Catholics who divorce and want to remarry. Divorced Catholics who remarry without a church annulment cannot currently receive communion. It is a heartache for many because Catholics believe communion, what they call the Eucharist, isn't just a symbol, but represents the real presence of Jesus Christ. Trent Mungi, who is married with two children and has never been divorced, says a change in that teaching might be overdue.
Communion is forefront in our faith. And whether a marriage ended, whatever that circumstance, I think communion is something that can help us through those things and not necessarily shun us.
Mungie teaches a catechism class for young adults. Many of them, he says, struggle to understand some church teachings. He tells them it is okay to question, and says he tries to stress Pope Francis's message of mercy.
There are a number of things that I feel are a bit of a contradiction. You know, I've always been raised and told that my God is a loving, forgiving God, and at times I believe our faith doesn't necessarily portray that.
But there is agreement on one thing. Pope Francis has certainly adopted a different tone than the two previous popes, John Paul II and Benedict XVI.
To them, it was more based on our dogma of our faith and following that dogma. And if you didn't follow it, you weren't, I don't want to say welcomed, but that's how I felt.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou.
After some more prayers and 13 hours of sitting in our cramped van, we arrive at midday to sunny Philadelphia. We find our way to the two Airbnb houses parishioner Bilo has leased for our two-day stay. None of us have tickets for any of the formal events, and our only hope of seeing Francis will be along the parade routes that have been set up for the Popemobile. That night, Bilo meets with the group to discuss logistics.
I mean, I'm thinking, though, that some people will be there.
Camped overnight.
I mean, they are for Black Friday. They're camped out for days. For Chick-fil-A, they were camped out for days.
We rule out an all-night campout, but decide to set out before dawn for the parade route along Benjamin Franklin Parkway, singing as we wait for our Uber driver to arrive.
This is the day that the Lord has made.
Let us rejoice.
Let us rejoice.
Most streets downtown are closed, and we have to walk a dozen or so blocks even after the taxi drops us off. National Guardsmen in their combat fatigues are stationed on corners. Officers at security checkpoints empty and examine the contents of purses and backpacks. They confiscate apples, bananas, and tin water bottles, anything that can be turned into projectiles. Jumbo screens set up at various locations show the Pope celebrating a Mass at Saints Peter and Paul Cathedral. The makeup of the crowd along the parade route underscores the international character of Catholicism. On one side of us is a Guatemalan woman with her daughter, waving her country's flag. On the other side, a group of Chaldean Rite Catholics from Iraq. After standing for 12 straight hours on our windy corner, the Pope finally appears at 7:15 p.m. It's dark, but the Popemobile is lit up, and Francis gets a rock star's welcome from the crowd. In person, he appears younger, more vigorous than on TV. But our glimpse of him is short-lived indeed. We see mostly the back of his head as he looks in the opposite direction passing by. But for these pilgrims, it's all they can talk about the next morning at breakfast.
He's probably so much like Christ, Pope that we've ever seen. I mean, he is like Christ, period. You know, he doesn't care who you are, what you are. He's there for you.
That's retired nurse Diane Wheelwright. And here's retired teacher Mary Husick.
We didn't even see the Pope's face after 12 hours plus of waiting. But it was great to see him. And it gives you a chill to think that you're that close to that man.
Banker Marlene Campin took away an important message from that brief encounter with the man known as the People's Pope.
If we would just all use our power with the numbers that we have, that we could really do a lot of good things. So if we could be very powerful if we would work together for the good of man.
Francis has changed nothing of church doctrine so far. But Susan Crumrine, who is raising two foster children with her partner, says she understands why some Catholics feel uncomfortable with the kinder, gentler tone he has adopted on some matters like homosexuality, divorce, and abortion.
I don't know if people feel like it's threatening our faith, but actually I think it's preserving our faith. The message of Christ is he loves us, period. He loves us.
The culmination of the Pope's visit to Philadelphia is an outdoor mass on the wide mall in front of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, whose steps Sylvester Stallone triumphantly scaled in a famous scene from the film Rocky. The mass is a ticketed event, and our group is not among the 250,000 invited guests, but we watch it with thousands of others on a public jumbo screen set up in front of City Hall. At the Mass, the Pope offers one of his most personal messages, encouraging all to practice what he calls, quote, small gestures of tenderness and compassion every day. The Lord's Prayer, then the sign of peace, offers an emotional moment as the pilgrims clasp hands and hug each other. Then Francis says farewell with what has become one of his signature lines.
Pray for me. Don't forget.
Pray for me, he says. Then he wags a finger like a kindly grandfather and adds, don't forget. Deacon Terry Stalsberg handed out communion on the mall near where the Pope celebrated Mass. Stalsberg brought communion for the members of our group, which they received at an impromptu communion service in the parking lot of a Sunoco gas station on the way
Behold
home from Philadelphia.
Behold him who takes away the sins of the world.
Letitia Hill, the elder of the group, seemed to sum up the general feeling in a prayer she offered on the drive home.
The friendships that we have formed during this weekend, I will never forget them. Lord, thank you so much for making us a gift to each other.
In one of his final talks, the Pope challenged American Catholics to ask themselves, what can I do for those most forgotten by society? It is a challenge these pilgrims from Central Illinois say they are ready to take up. I'm Judy Valente, WGLT News.
And you're tuned to Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern.
This week on Radiolab,
this.
The big mystery. How it is that just a bunch of these
little wisps of jelly in your head are called neurons
flashing on and off in your brain create
thoughts, ambitions, passions.
You.
Even what you think of as your own intimate self.
And how, in a flash, that could all change.
In an instant, we can be completely transformed.
I'm Jad Abumrad. Join me for Radiolab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT. And this is Best of Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. The information age has opened new possibilities of both establishing relationships with other people and abusing them. The Virtual Enemy is a new book co-authored by Shelley Clevenger of Illinois State University. It focuses on the relationships of intimate partners and cybercrime. In this conversation with WGLT's Charlie Schlenker, Clevenger says the two have historically been treated as separate issues, but there is an intersection.
We're seeing more of it now, especially with young people, with people being able to have access to their partner's cell phones, email accounts, social media. It's really, I hate to use the word taking off, but this area is much more increasing because of our use of technology than it has in the past.
It's just another tool for a violent act, and I'm a little surprised that people have viewed it as separate.
I am too, and in the past, there was limited resources for victims going to the police. We are seeing now special task force within certain departments and different laws targeting these offenses. But in the past, people didn't really see this as something that was connected or something that they were able to fight the same way they were able to fight in-person crime.
A lot of what we think of as traditional domestic violence is based on power and control. How does cybercrime fit that or expand upon it?
In much of the same way, a abuser could actually take control of your cell phone using different software, also be able to control your email, change your email passwords, change your passwords for social media, take out credit cards in your name, mortgages, all of these things to be able to control you in a totally different way than we have thought of with intimate partner abuse in the past.
How does that happen? What do people experience?
It could be that person actually taking your cell phone and doing these things, or it could be they knew your password, or they were able to take control of that. One of the interviews that I recently did, her partner tracked her cell phone, and he was able to see, using this spyware, everything that she did. So where she went, what website she went to, anything. So she actually had tried to reach out to a sexual assault hotline on the internet. They had an open chat. He was able to see everything that she said using this spyware on her phone that he installed.
In terms of control, though, traditionally it's a sort of a don't make me angry or X will happen, or I will abuse you and intimidate you and bully you into doing what I want preventatively. How does cybercrime fit that model, or is it more surreptitious in its exercise of control?
It can be that. One of the things that people will threaten their victims with is the new kind of term revenge porn, of putting naked pictures or videos online. The people use that as a threat. You know, you need to listen to me or do what I say or else this could happen. It's also about socially isolating them. Some abusers will actually send emails or messages from the victim's social media account to their family or their coworkers, saying things that are not true, saying they don't want to see them anymore, saying that they have a drug problem, all sorts of lies. So they can threaten them with those sorts of things in a way that's different than in the past.
Is this sort of act more susceptible to discovery and verification than other kinds of relationship violence?
It could be. The issue becomes, did the offender have the access, or did the person do it themselves? So a lot of abusers will say, I didn't do that. That's her email account. She did that. She did all of those things. I did not have any access to that. It just depends. Sometimes we can tell by, they can have an app on their phone where if I was an abuser, I could have an app on my phone to be able to track my significant other. That's easy to detect, those sorts of things. Or being able to see the history on the computer if I was at work, what I did monitoring my significant other. But it can be difficult to track and to prove that the abuser committed these crimes.
There are often warning signs in relationship violence in the traditional sense. The desire to know where someone is at all times, the desire to limit their outside contacts. In the early stages of an abusive relationship, does the cyber element come out as well, or is that happening later in the relationship?
Some of those warning signs are present right away. Oftentimes, it's wanting to know what you were doing online or who your friends are on Facebook, or if someone leaves a comment on your Facebook wall, that person might be, the abuser might be asking, who's that? What's your relationship to them? Wanting to know what emails you've sent, wanting to know your online whereabouts, just like someone would be interested in your physical world whereabouts.
And that's a little more tenuous sometimes in identifying that that's an unhealthy behavior.
Yeah. Some victims think that their abusers were just interested in what they were doing, but there's a difference between taking an interest and wanting to monitor all of your online activity, or wanting to, if you're sitting there at your computer reading emails, someone wanting to read the emails or go through your emails with you, which a lot of victims look back and say, you know, I think it was kind of strange. He wanted to read all of my emails, or he wanted to see all of my friends on Facebook and me tell them exactly who they were in relation to me.
Yikes.
Yeah, so there are some warning signs that people can identify.
How should domestic violence social workers help people navigate this new territory?
This can be often really difficult for people working in the field because it is new. There are some programs where you're able to have an app on your phone that can alert you if someone has spyware on your phone or your computer, and also being able to clear your history. But it's also, there's a checklist out to be able to kind of see if there are these warning signs that you would see in actual physical type behaviors. Wanting to have access to all of your passwords is another sort of trigger. So providing people who work with victims a sort of checklist for virtual intimate partner abuse could help victims recognize that. Because some of the people that I had interviewed, they had said, you know, I just thought that he was being careful or helping me be safe by asking me for a list of my passwords. Now, to most people, we would think that would be, you know, a warning sign, but to someone who's in this relationship, it might not. So by having that information at domestic violence shelters or even education seminars that are done, I think we need to include this online warning sign component as opposed to just the real world violence aspect.
Shelley Clevenger is a professor of criminal justice sciences at Illinois State University and the co-author of the upcoming book, The Virtual Enemy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Clevenger spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Her co-authors on the book are Catherine Markham of Appalachian State University and Jordana Navarro of Tennessee Tech. WGLT.org is where you can find the Sound Ideas archive and podcast, including this episode, provided with help from Bruce Bergathon, Laura Kennedy, Judy Valente, and Charlie Schlenker. We want to know what you think of the interviews and stories on Sound Ideas. Get in touch at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. This is WGLT Normal.